This is Audible.
Audible is pleased to present the heirloom edition of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. This new edition includes a new preface by author Seth Graham Smith, an afterword by Dr. Alan Grove, professor of English literature at Alfred University, and new scenes of gratuitous zombie mayhem.
Audible Incorporated presents Pride and Prejudice and Zombies by Jane Austen and Seth Graham Smith. Read by Catherine Kellgren.
Sometime in the spring of 2008, as I whiled away the morning hours in my home office, obsessively refreshing election news sites, thinking about what I was going to have for lunch, and occasionally working, the phone rang. Jason Rakulak was the only editor I'd ever worked with, and over the course of four books, we'd exchanged hundreds of calls and thousands of emails. We'd established something of an electronic shorthand. So when I heard him say, "Hey Seth, it's Jason," I knew something was up at once. There was a restlessness in his voice, an electricity. This was no, "I need another 500 words to fill some space" call. This was the voice of a man possessed, a man struck by a lightning bolt of inspiration. That, or he'd suddenly developed a raging OxyContin habit. "Okay, I just need you to listen," he began. Just listen and tell me if I'm crazy. All I have is a title. It's just a title, but I can't stop thinking about it. Just promise me you'll wait a minute before you say anything, okay?" I promised. The next words out of his mouth were Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I broke my promise. I didn't wait a minute. I didn't need to. He'd barely finished the word zombies before my head was flooded with images of aristocrats being eaten alive, of the Bennet girls flying around crouching tiger style, of Mr. Darcy riding into battle atop his mighty steed, his glorious chestnut mane awash in musket smoke. My loins began to quiver as I imagined the joy of writing ridiculous, gratuitous scenes of violence and gore in the imitated style of Jane Austen, and the blood, oh, the blood. I told him it was the most brilliant idea I'd ever heard, and I meant it. I was hooked. We talked for an hour or so, excitedly trading ideas about tone, style, body count. There were no discussions of bestseller lists. Of the four books we'd done together at that point, I don't think any had cracked Amazon's top 3,000, nor do we expect any ever would. There were no dreams of movie adaptations, audiobooks, or Croatian translations. It just seemed like a lot of fun, which was the only reason we'd ever decided to do a book together in the past. Well, that and I needed the money, but mostly the fun. That afternoon, as I began rereading the original, it had been years since I struggled through it in high school, Jason began the prodigious task of convincing his publishing executives to say yes. For a while, it seemed like he and I were the only two people on the planet who thought this was a brilliant idea. Many were justifiably skeptical. After all, wouldn't the Austen bits bore the zombie lovers? Wouldn't the zombie bits turn off the Janeites? But after seeing a sample and seeing how passionate, or high, we were, Quirk Books decided to take a chance. What we didn't know, what no one could have imagined, was that we had just embarked on the most important contribution to the printed word since the Gutenberg Bible. Steve Gutenberg, not Johannes Gutenberg. I put the election news sites away and got to work. After rereading the original, I re-reread it, making notes in the margins, jotting down ideas, and working out the logistics of weaving a zombie uprising into one of the most celebrated novels in the English language. If I changed something in Chapter 6, what were the consequences in Chapter 56? What were these new zombie sequences going to be, and how could I evenly distribute them throughout the book? What kind of zombies were these? Where did they come from? What were Elizabeth's abilities? Where was she trained? Would any of this work, or were we just kidding ourselves? Once I had most of these logistics worked out, I opened the original manuscript on my computer, thank you, internets, and set about changing words, adding lines, and inserting all new scenes, one bloody page at a time. In order to keep track of my changes, I made the new text red, it seemed appropriate. Sometimes there'd be two or three page blocks of all new, all red action. Sometimes there'd be a red paragraph or a few red lines on a mostly black page. Sometimes there was only a red word or two. As I wrote, I constantly zoomed out to view the manuscript as a whole, judging my success by how much red I'd left behind. My self-imposed rule was to change something on every page, no matter what. I worked 7 days a week, usually until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, almost always with Nine Inch Nails Ghosts 1 through 4 or a Jerry Goldsmith score blaring in my earbuds for inspiration. By the way, as you listen to the book, you can tell where it was getting late. Just listen for the vomit gags and ball innuendos. When I turned in the manuscript on July 31st, 2008, I curled up on the floor and wept. Okay, not really, but suffice it to say, it was the most fun I've ever had writing in my life, and I was sorry to see it end. 8 months later, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was an international bestseller, and we all looked like geniuses. Best of all, the book was mostly well-received. If there was any consistent criticism, it boiled down to, we want more zombies. With this new edition, that's exactly what you get. I've gone back and added new words, lines, paragraphs, and all new scenes of ultra-violent mayhem throughout. There are also some incredible new paintings by Roberto Parada. Throw in a faux leather binding and a new cover by Quirk's Doogie Horner, and you've got yourself one hell of a collector's item. Or, at the very least, something with enough heft to be used as a weapon in the event of a zombie uprising. It's worth noting that, as of this writing anyway, Jason Rakulak and I have yet to meet in person. Ah, the digital age. When we finally do, I'll shake his hand and thank him for that phone call, for his lightning bolt of inspiration, for the 5 words that changed my life. And then, I'll eat his brains. Seth Graham Smith.
Chapter 1. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains. Never was this truth more plain than during the recent attacks at Netherfield Park, in which a household of 18 was slaughtered and consumed by a horde of the living dead. "My dear Mr. Bennett," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is occupied again?" Mr. Bennett replied that he had not, and went about his morning business of dagger sharpening and musket polishing, for attacks by the unmentionables had grown alarmingly frequent in recent weeks. "But it is," returned she. Mr. Bennett made no answer. "Do you not want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently.
"Woman, I am attending to my musket. Prattle on if you must, but leave me to the defense of my estate."
This was invitation enough. "Why, my dear, Mrs. Long says that Netherfield is taken by a young man of large fortune, that he escaped London in a chaise and four just as the strange plague broke through the Manchester line."
"What is his name?"
"Bingley. A single man of 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for our girls."
"How so? Can he train them in the ways of swordsmanship and musketry?"
"How can you be so tiresome? You must know that I am thinking of his marrying one of them."
"Marriage? In times such as these? Surely this Bingley has no such designs."
"Designs? Nonsense! How can you talk so? It is very likely that he may fall in love with one of them, and therefore you must visit him as soon as he comes."
"I see no occasion for that. And besides, we mustn't busy the roads more than is absolutely necessary, lest we lose more horses and carriages to the unfortunate scourge that has so troubled our beloved Hertfordshire of late."
"But consider your daughters."
"I am considering them, silly woman. I would much prefer their minds be engaged in the deadly arts than clouded with dreams of marriage and fortune, as yours so clearly is. Go and see this Bingley, if you must. Though I warn you that none of our girls has much to recommend them. They are all silly and ignorant like their mother, the exception being Lizzie, who has something more of the killer instinct than her sisters."
"Mr. Bennett, how can you abuse your own children in such a way? You take delight in vexing me. You have no compassion for my poor nerves."
"You mistake me, my dear. I have a high respect for your nerves. They are my old friends. I have heard of little else these last 20 years at least." Mr. Bennett was so odd a mixture of quick parts, sarcastic humour, reserve and self-discipline, that the experience of 23 years had been insufficient to make his wife understand his character. Her mind was less difficult to develop. She was a woman of mean understanding, little information, and uncertain temper. When she was discontented, she fancied herself nervous. And when she was nervous, as she was nearly all the time since the first outbreak of the strange plague in her youth, She sought solace in the comfort of the traditions which now seemed mere trifles to others. The business of Mr. Bennet's life was to keep his daughters alive. The business of Mrs. Bennet's was to get them married. Chapter 2. Mr. Bennet was among the earliest of those who waited on Mr. Bingley. He had always intended to visit him, though to the last always assuring his wife that he should not go. Until the evening after the visit was paid, she had no knowledge of it. It was then disclosed in the following manner. Observing his second daughter employed in carving the Bennet crest in the handle of a new sword, he suddenly addressed her with, "I hope Mr. Bingley will like it, Lizzie."
"We are not in a way to know what Mr. Bingley likes," said her mother resentfully, "since we are not to visit."
"But you forget, Mama," said Elizabeth, "that we shall meet him at the next ball." Mrs. Bennet deigned not to make any reply, but, unable to contain herself, began scolding one of her daughters.
"Don't keep coughing so, Kitty, for heaven's sake. You sound as if you have been stricken."
"Mother, what a dreadful thing to say with so many zombies about," replied Kitty fretfully. "When is your next ball to be, Lizzie?"
"Tomorrow fortnight."
"Aye, so it is," cried her mother, "and it will be impossible to introduce him, since we shall not know him ourselves. Oh, how I wish I had never heard the name Bingley!"
"I am sorry to hear that," said Mr. Bennet. "If I had known as much this morning, I certainly would not have called on him. It is very unlucky, but as I have actually paid the visit, we cannot escape the acquaintance now."
The astonishment of the ladies was just what he wished, that of Mrs. Bennet perhaps surpassing the rest, though when the first tumult of joy was over, she began to declare that it was what she had expected all the while.
"How good it was in you, my dear Mr. Bennet! But I knew I should persuade you at last. I was sure you loved your girls too well to neglect such an acquaintance. Well, how pleased I am, and it is such a good joke, too, that you should have gone this morning and never said a word about it till now."
"Do not mistake my indulgence for a relaxation in discipline," said Mr. Bennet. "The girls shall continue their training as ever, Bingley or no Bingley."
"Of course, of course," cried Mrs. Bennet. "They shall be as deadly as they are fetching."
"Now, Kitty, you may cough as much as you choose," said Mr. Bennet, and as he spoke he left the room, fatigued with the raptures of his wife.
"What an excellent father you have, girls," said she when the door was shut. "Such joys are scarce since the good Lord saw fit to shut the gates of hell and doom the dead to walk amongst us. Lydia, my love, though you are the youngest, I dare say Mr. Bingley will dance with you at the next ball."
"Oh," said Lydia stoutly, "I am not afraid, for though I am the youngest, I am also the most proficient in the art of tempting the other sex."
The rest of the evening was spent in conjecturing how soon Mr. Bingley would return Mr. Bennet's visit, and determining when they should ask him to dinner.
Chapter 3. Not all that Mrs. Bennet, however, with the assistance of her five daughters, could ask on the subject was sufficient to draw from her husband any satisfactory description of Mr. Bingley. They attacked him in various ways, with barefaced questions, ingenious suppositions, and distant surmises, but he eluded the skill of them all, and they were at last obliged to accept the second-hand intelligence of their neighbour, Lady Lucas. Her report was highly favourable. Sir William had been delighted with him. He was quite young, wonderfully handsome, and to crown the whole, he meant to be at the next ball with a large party. Nothing could be more delightful.
"If I can but see one of my daughters happily settled at Netherfield," said Mrs. Bennet to her husband, "and all the others equally well married, I shall have nothing to wish for."
"And if I can see all five of them survive England's present difficulties, then neither shall I," he replied.
The sisters Bennet were true to their word. As the evening of the ball approached, they trained more frequently and fervently than ever before. All of them, save Mary, were thus engaged in the family dojo on a Sunday morning when their sparring was interrupted by the sound of distant hoof-falls.
5 horses, said Elizabeth, closing her eyes, less than a mile away and approaching with no want of haste.
On the Lord's Day, said Kitty, what can it mean?
Are they unfriendly in intent? Asked Jane. Elizabeth listened fixedly for a moment longer than Jane's patience could bear.
Quickly, Lizzie!
3 of them carry muskets.
2 arms!
Ordered Jane, upon which the 4 ladies hurried out of doors. Mary was already running towards them with her longbow across the modest lawn that separated the house from the dojo.
"Galloping so on the Lord's Day!" cried Mary as she ran. "What can it mean?"
The sisters met in the middle of the lawn and stood together, girded for battle, and the 5 distant horses and their riders grew closer.
"Remember, cut down their horses first," said Jane, "so that we might meet them on the ground."
"My dear Jane," said Elizabeth, readying her katana, "it is far more expedient to take 1 head from a man than 4 legs from a horse." Happily, the taking of legs and heads would prove unnecessary, for when the lead rider was close enough, he pulled back his reins and threw his hands in the air. His companions, all of them living men of varying age, did likewise. All wore similar black hats, the style of which was unknown to Elizabeth.
"What mean you, galloping so on the Lord's Day?" demanded Jane.
"Honoured Sisters Bennet," said the lead rider, "we come to beg your assistance with a most unpleasant matter."
Less than a quarter hour after these words were spoken, the sisters found themselves racing towards the village of Shepherd's Bath on horseback, each of them clinging to the back of a rider, none more tightly than Lydia, though not for fear of falling. It was 11 miles from Longbourn, and the wooded path was pleasantly free of the unmentionable menace. However, the group had scarcely ventured more than a few miles before they perceived a dark column of smoke rising in the distance.
"My God!" cried the lead rider. "I fear we gallop in vain."
Shepherd's Bath was quite small in comparison to the nearby villages of Meryton and Bastard's Hollow. It consisted of little more than a church, a few shops, and blacksmith, and for nearly 2 years it had remained untouched by the claws of Satan. Sunday morning, however, had brought an end to this run of good luck. With nearly the whole of the village gathered for worship, the church had been overrun by a herd of dreadfuls. The blacksmith and his sons, who had not been at worship on account of their being descendants of Moses, had ridden to Longbourn for help. Upon reaching the church, the sisters Bennet leapt from their horses and readied their weapons. Lydia, her shooting irons, Kitty, her quarterstaff, Mary, her longbow, and Jane and Lizzie, their katanas. There was, however, little combat to be had, for they had indeed arrived too late to help the wretched parishioners, just as the Jewish blacksmith had feared. The whole of the church was swallowed in flames.
"Those miserable people," said Jane. "I can but pray that the fire eased their deaths."
Upon seeing a house of God so defiled, Mary could not help her tears.
"Need we any more evidence that the devil is behind England's sorrows? Need we further attestation that our cause is hopeless?"
"Control yourself," cried Elizabeth. "Your tears bring shame to our master." There was still work to be done. Though the townspeople were beyond help, there remained a handful of unmentionables about, several of them on fire. A group of 3 feasted on the charred remains of a deacon, biting off pieces of his blackened scalp in hopes of reaching the boiled brain beneath it. Out of the corner of her eye, Lizzie caught the blacksmith and his sons quietly vomiting into their hats.
"Very well, sisters," said Jane. "Let us convey them to hell and be done with it."
"No," said Elizabeth. "Let Mary do it. Alone."
Jane nodded her approval. Mary, whose eyes were now shamefully swollen and red, knew better than to defy the 2 eldest, especially Lizzie. She collected herself, eschewed her longbow in favour of an ankle dagger, and made quick work of cutting down zombie after wretched zombie, taking no pleasure in it, and privately thinking it an exercise in futility. Her honour thus restored, and their business in Shepherd's Bath concluded, the sisters were conveyed to Longbourn by the Israelites. A few days later, Mr. Bingley returned Mr. Bennet's visit, and sat about 10 minutes with him in his library. He had entertained hopes of being admitted to a sight of the young ladies, of whose beauty and fighting skill he had heard much, But he saw only the father. The ladies were somewhat more fortunate, for they had the advantage of ascertaining from an upper window that he wore a blue coat, rode a black horse, and carried a French carbine rifle upon his back. Quite an exotic weapon for an Englishman. However, from his clumsy wielding of it, Elizabeth was quite certain that he had little training in musketry or any of the deadly arts. An invitation to dinner was soon afterwards dispatched, and already had Mrs. Bennet planned the courses that were to do credit to her housekeeping when an answer arrived which deferred it all. Mr. Bingley was obliged to be in town the following day, and consequently unable to accept the honour of their invitation, etc. Mrs. Bennet was quite disconcerted. She could not imagine what business he could have in town so soon after his arrival in Hertfordshire. Lady Lucas quieted her fears a little by starting the idea of his being gone to London only to retrieve a large party for the ball, and a report soon followed that Mr. Bingley was to bring 12 ladies and 7 gentlemen with him to the assembly. The girls grieved over such a number of ladies, but were comforted by hearing that instead of 12 he brought only 6 with him from London, his 5 sisters and a cousin. And when the party entered the ball, it consisted of only 5 altogether: Mr. Bingley, his 2 sisters, the husband of the eldest, and another young man. Mr. Bingley was good-looking and gentlemanlike. He had a pleasant countenance and easy, unaffected manners. His sisters were fine women, with an air of decided fashion, but little in the way of combat training. His brother-in-law, Mr. Hurst, merely looked the gentleman, but his friend Mr. Darcy soon drew the attention of the room by his fine, tall person, handsome features, noble mien, and the report, which was in general circulation within 5 minutes after his entrance, of his having slaughtered more than 1,000 unmentionables since the fall of Cambridge. The gentleman pronounced him to be a fine figure of a man. The ladies declared he was much handsomer than Mr. Bingley, and he was looked at with great admiration until his manners gave a disgust which turned the tide of his popularity, for he was discovered to be proud, to be above his company, and above being pleased. Mr. Bingley had soon made himself acquainted with all the principal people in the room. He was lively and unreserved, danced every dance, was angry that the ball closed so early, and talked of giving one himself at Netherfield. And though he lacked Mr. Darcy's proficiency with both sword and musket, such amiable qualities must speak for themselves. What a contrast! Mr. Darcy was the proudest, most disagreeable man in the world, and everybody hoped that he would never come there again. Amongst the most violent against him was Mrs. Bennet, whose dislike of his general behaviour was sharpened into particular resentment by his having slighted one of her daughters. Elizabeth Bennet had been obliged, by the scarcity of gentlemen, to sit down for 2 dances, and during part of that time Mr. Darcy had been standing near enough for her to hear a conversation between him and Mr. Bingley, who came from the dance for a few minutes to press his friend to join it. "Come, Darcy," said he, "I must have you dance. I hate to see you standing about by yourself in this stupid manner." "I certainly shall not. You know how I detest it, unless I am particularly acquainted with my partner. At such an assembly as this it would be insupportable. Your sisters are engaged, and there is not another woman in the room whom it would not be a punishment to me to stand up with." "Upon my honour," cried Mr. Bingley, "I never met with so many pleasant girls in my life as I have this evening, and there are several of them, you see, uncommonly pretty." "You are dancing with the only handsome girl in the room," said Mr. Darcy, looking at the eldest, Miss Bennet. "Oh, she is the most beautiful creature I ever beheld. But there is one of her sisters sitting down just behind you who is very pretty, and I dare say very agreeable."
"Which do you mean?"
And turning round, he looked for a moment at Elizabeth, till catching her eye, he withdrew his own and coldly said,
"She is tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me. I am in no humour at present to give consequence to young ladies who are slighted by other men."
As Mr. Darcy walked off, Elizabeth felt her blood turn cold. She had never in her life been so insulted. The warrior code demanded she avenge her honour. Elizabeth reached down to her ankle, taking care not to draw attention. There, her hand met the dagger concealed beneath her dress. She meant to follow this proud Mr. Darcy outside and open his throat. But no sooner had she grabbed the handle of her weapon than a chorus of screams filled the assembly hall, immediately joined by the shattering of window panes. Unmentionables poured in, their movements clumsy yet swift, their burial clothing in a range of untidiness. Some wore gowns so tattered as to render them scandalous. Others wore suits so filthy that one would assume they were assembled from little more than dirt and dried blood. Their flesh was in varying degrees of putrefaction. The freshly stricken were slightly green and pliant, whereas the longer dead were grey and brittle, their eyes and tongues long since turned to dust, and their lips pulled back into everlasting skeletal smiles. A few of the guests, who had the misfortune of being too near the windows, were seized and feasted on at once. When Elizabeth stood, she saw Mrs. Long struggle to free herself as two female dreadfuls bit into her head, cracking her skull like a walnut, and sending a shower of dark blood spouting as high as the chandeliers. As the guests fled in every direction, Mr. Bennet's voice cut through the commotion, "Girls, pentagram of death!" Elizabeth immediately joined her four sisters, Jane, Mary, Catherine, and Lydia, in the center of the dance floor. Each girl produced a dagger from her ankle and stood at the tip of an imaginary five-pointed star. From the center of the room, they began stepping outward in unison, each thrusting a razor-sharp dagger with one hand, the other hand modestly tucked into the small of her back. From a corner of the room, Mr. Darcy watched Elizabeth and her sisters work their way outward, beheading zombie after zombie as they went. He knew of only one other woman in all of Great Britain who wielded a dagger with such skill, such grace, and deadly accuracy. By the time the girls reached the walls of the assembly hall, the last of the unmentionables lay still. Apart from the attack, the evening altogether passed off pleasantly for the whole family. Mrs. Bennet had seen her eldest daughter much admired by the Netherfield party. Mr. Bingley had danced with her twice, and she had been distinguished by his sisters. Jane was as much gratified by this as her mother could be, though in a quieter way. Elizabeth felt Jane's pleasure. Mary had heard herself mentioned to Miss Bingley as the most accomplished girl in the neighbourhood. And Catherine and Lydia had been fortunate enough never to be without partners, which was all that they had yet learnt to care for at a ball. They returned, therefore, in good spirits to Longbourn, the village where they lived, and of which they were the principal inhabitants. Chapter 4. When Jane and Elizabeth were alone, the former, who had been cautious in her praise of Mr. Bingley before, expressed to her sister just how very much she admired him.
"He is just what a young man ought to be," said she. "Sensible, good-humoured, lively, and I never saw such happy manners, so much ease, with such perfect good breeding."
"Yes," replied Elizabeth, "but in the heat of battle neither he nor Mr. Darcy were to be found with blade or bludgeon."
"Well, I was very much flattered by his asking me to dance a second time. I did not expect such a compliment."
"He certainly is very agreeable, and I give you leave to like him despite his lack of gallantry. You have liked many a stupider person."
"Dear Lizzie. Oh, you are a great deal too apt, you know, to like people in general. You never see a fault in anybody. I never heard you speak ill of a human being in your life."
"I would not wish to be hasty in censuring anyone."
"With your good sense, to be so honestly blind to the follies and nonsense of others. You like this man's sisters, too, do you? Their manners are not equal to his."
They were, in fact, very fine ladies, not deficient in the power of making themselves agreeable when they chose it, but proud and conceited. They were rather handsome, had been educated in one of the first private seminaries in town, but knew little of the deadly arts in which she and her own sisters had been so thoroughly trained, both in England and during their trips to the Orient. As for Mr. Bingley himself, between him and Darcy there was a very steady friendship, in spite of great opposition of character. Bingley was by no means deficient, but Darcy was clever. He was at the same time haughty, reserved, and fastidious, and his manners, though well-bred, were not inviting. In that respect, his friend had greatly the advantage. Bingley was sure of being liked wherever he appeared. Darcy was continually giving offence. But what no one, not even Mr. Bingley, knew, was the reason behind Darcy's cold demeanour. For until recently he had been the very picture of pleasantry, a young man of merry disposition and utmost attentiveness. But his nature had been forever altered by a betrayal he had not the stomach to speak of. Chapter 5. Within a short, though perilous, walk of Longbourn lived a family with whom the Bennets were particularly intimate. Sir William Lucas had been formerly a maker of fine burial gowns of such stately beauty that the king had seen fit to knight him. He had made a tolerable fortune until the strange plague had rendered his services unnecessary. Few thought it worth the expense to dress the dead in finery when they would only soil it upon crawling out of their graves. He had removed with his family to a house about a mile from Meryton. Lady Lucas was a very good kind of woman, not too clever to be a valuable neighbour to Mrs. Bennet. They had several children. The eldest of them, a sensible, intelligent young woman, about 27, was Elizabeth's intimate friend.
"You began the evening well, Charlotte," said Mrs. Bennet, with civil self-command, to Miss Lucas. "You were Mr. Bingley's first choice."
"Yes, but he seemed to like his second better."
"Oh, you mean Jane, I suppose, because he danced with her twice, and because she fought so valiantly against the unmentionables.
Did I not mention what I heard between him and Mr. Robinson?
Mr. Robinson's asking Mr. Bingley how he liked our Meryton assemblies, and whether he did not think there were very many pretty women in the room, and which he thought the prettiest, and his answering immediately to the last question, 'Oh, the eldest Miss Bennet, beyond a doubt. There cannot be two opinions on that point.'
Upon my word! Well, that is very decided indeed.
Mr. Darcy is not so well worth listening to as his friend, is he?" said Charlotte. "Poor Eliza, to be called only tolerable. I beg you would not put it into Lizzie's head to be vexed by his ill-treatment, for he is such a disagreeable man that it would be quite a misfortune to be liked by him. Mrs. Long told me last night."
Mrs. Bennet's voice failed her at the thought of poor Mrs. Long, her skull crushed betwixt the teeth of those wretched creatures. The lady sat in silent contemplation for a few moments.
"Miss Bingley told me," said Jane, finally, "that he never speaks much, unless among his intimate acquaintances. With them he is remarkably agreeable."
"His pride," said Miss Lucas, "does not offend me so much as pride often does, because there is an excuse for it. One cannot wonder that so very fine a young man, with family, fortune, everything in his favour, should think highly of himself. If I may so express it, he has a right to be proud."
"That is very true," replied Elizabeth, "and I could easily forgive his pride if he had not mortified mine. I dare say I would have cut his throat had not the unmentionables distracted me from doing so."
"Pride," observed Mary, who piqued herself upon the solidity of her reflections, "is a very common failing, I believe. By all that I have ever read, I am convinced that it is very common indeed."
Elizabeth could not help but roll her eyes as Mary continued.
"Vanity and pride are different things, though the words are often used synonymously. A person may be proud without being vain. Pride relates more to our opinion of ourselves, vanity to what we would have others think of us."
At this point, Elizabeth let out a most palpable yawn.
Though she admired Mary's bravery in battle, she had always found her a trifle dull in relaxed company.
Chapter 6.
The ladies of Longbourn soon waited on those of Netherfield. Jane's pleasing manners grew on the goodwill of Mrs. Hurst and Miss Bingley, and though the mother was found to be intolerable, and the younger sisters not worth speaking to, a wish of being better acquainted with them was expressed towards the two eldest. By Jane this attention was received with the greatest pleasure, but Elizabeth still saw superciliousness in their treatment of everybody. It was generally evident, whenever they met, that Mr. Bingley did admire her, and to her it was equally evident that Jane was in a way to be very much in love, but she considered with pleasure that it was not likely to be discovered by the world in general. Elizabeth mentioned this to her friend, Miss Lucas.
"It may perhaps be pleasant," replied Charlotte, "but it is sometimes a disadvantage to be so very guarded. If a woman conceals her affection with the same skill from the object of it, she may lose the opportunity of fixing him.
In 9 cases out of 10, a woman had better show more affection than she feels. Bingley likes your sister undoubtedly, but he may never do more than like her if she does not help him on.
But she does help him on, as much as her nature will allow. Remember, Charlotte, she is a warrior first and a woman second."
"Well," said Charlotte, "I wish Jane success with all my heart. And if she were married to him tomorrow, I should think she had as good a chance of happiness as if she were to be studying his character for a 12-month. Happiness in marriage is entirely a matter of chance, and it is better to know as little as possible of the defects of the person with whom you are to pass your life."
"You make me laugh, Charlotte, but it is not sound. You know it is not sound, and that you would never act in this way yourself."
"Remember, Elizabeth, I am not a warrior, as you are. I am merely a silly girl of 27 years, and that without a husband."
Occupied in observing Mr. Bingley's attentions to her sister, Elizabeth was far from suspecting that she was herself becoming an object of some interest in the eyes of his friend. Mr. Darcy had at first scarcely allowed her to be pretty. He had looked at her without admiration at the ball, and when they next met he looked at her only to criticise. But no sooner had he made it clear to himself and his friends that she hardly had a good feature in her face then he began to find it was rendered uncommonly intelligent by the beautiful expression of her dark eyes and her uncommon skill with a blade. To this discovery succeeded some others equally mortifying. Though he had detected more than one failure of perfect symmetry in her form, he was forced to acknowledge her figure to be light and pleasing, and her arms surprisingly muscular, though not so much as to diminish her femininity. He began to wish to know more of her, and as a step towards conversing with her himself, attended to her conversation with others. His doing so drew her notice. It was at Sir William Lucas's, where a large party were assembled.
"What does Mr. Darcy mean," said she to Charlotte, "by listening to my conversation with Colonel Foster?"
"That is a question which Mr. Darcy only can answer."
"Well, if he does it any more, I shall certainly let him know that I see what he is about. I have not yet forgiven him for insulting my honour, and may yet have his head upon my mantle."
Mr. Darcy approached them soon afterwards. Elizabeth turned to him and said,
"Did you not think, Mr. Darcy, that I expressed myself uncommonly well just now when I was teasing Colonel Foster to give us a ball at Meryton?"
"With great energy. But balls are always a subject which makes a lady energetic."
"It depends on who's throwing them, Mr. Darcy."
"Well," said Miss Lucas, her face suddenly flushed, "I am going to open the instrument, Eliza, and you know what follows. You are a very strange creature by way of a friend, always wanting me to play and sing before anybody and everybody."
Elizabeth's performance was pleasing, though by no means capital. After a song or two, she was eagerly succeeded at the instrument by her sister Mary, who, at the end of a long concerto, joined eagerly in dancing with her younger sisters, some of the Lucases, and 2 or 3 officers at one end of the room. Mr. Darcy stood near them in silent indignation at such a mode of passing the evening, to the exclusion of all conversation, and was too much engrossed by his thoughts to perceive that Sir William Lucas stood beside him, till Sir William thus began.
"What a charming amusement for young people this is, Mr. Darcy." Certainly, sir. And it has the advantage also of being in vogue amongst the less polished societies of the world. Every savage can dance. Why, I imagine even zombies could do it with some degree of success. Sir William only smiled, not sure of how to converse with so rude a gentleman. He was much relieved at the sight of Elizabeth approaching. "My dear Miss Eliza, why are you not dancing? Mr. Darcy, you must allow me to present this young lady to you as a very desirable partner. You cannot refuse to dance, I am sure, when so much beauty is before you." He took Miss Bennet's hand and presented it to Mr. Darcy, who was not unwilling to receive it. But she instantly drew back and said with some discomposure to Sir William, "Indeed, sir, I have not the least intention of dancing. I entreat you not to suppose that I moved this way in order to beg for a partner." Mr. Darcy, with grave propriety, requested the honour of her hand, but in vain. Elizabeth was determined. She looked archly and turned away. Her resistance had not injured her with Mr. Darcy, for indeed he was thinking of her with some complacency when thus accosted by Miss Bingley.
"I can guess the subject of your reverie."
"I should imagine not."
"You are considering how insupportable it would be to pass many evenings in this manner. The insipidity, the noise, the nothingness, and yet the self-importance of all those people. What would I give to hear your strictures on them?"
"Your conjecture is totally wrong, I assure you. My mind was more agreeably engaged. I have been meditating on the very great pleasure which a pair of fine eyes in the face of a pretty woman can bestow." Miss Bingley immediately fixed her eyes on his face and desired he would tell her what lady had the credit of inspiring such reflections. Mr. Darcy replied, "Miss Elizabeth Bennet."
"Miss Elizabeth Bennet," repeated Miss Bingley, "defender of Longbourn, heroine of Hertfordshire. I am all astonishment. He will be having a charming mother-in-law indeed. And of course the two of you would fell many an unmentionable with your combined proficiencies in the deadly arts."
He listened to her with perfect indifference while she chose to entertain herself in this manner, and as his composure convinced her that all was safe, her wit flowed long. Chapter 7 Mr. Bennet's property consisted almost entirely in an estate of 2,000 a year, which, unfortunately for his daughters, was entailed, in default of heirs male, on a distant relation, and unfortunately for all, was surrounded on all sides by high ground, making it troublesome to defend. Their mother's fortune, though ample for her situation in life, could but ill supply the deficiency of his. Her father had been an attorney in Meryton, and had left her £4,000. She had a sister married to a Mr. Phillips, who had been a clerk to their father and succeeded him in the business, and a brother settled in London, where he had earned his letters in science, and where he now owned a pair of factories dedicated to the war effort. The village of Longbourn was only 1 mile from Meryton, a most convenient distance for the young ladies, who were usually tempted thither 3 or 4 times a week, despite the unmentionables which frequently beset travellers along the road, to pay their duty to their aunt and to a milliner's shop just over the way. The two youngest of the family, Catherine and Lydia, were particularly frequent in these attentions. Their minds were more vacant than their sisters', and when nothing better offered, a walk to Meryton was necessary to amuse their morning hours and occasionally practice their skills. At present, indeed, they were well supplied both with news and happiness by the recent arrival of a militia regiment in the neighbourhood. It was to remain the whole winter, wresting coffins from the hardened earth and setting fire to them. Meryton was to be the headquarters. Their visits to Mrs. Phillips were now productive of the most interesting intelligence. Every day added something to their knowledge of the officers' names and connections, and fresh news from the battlefields of Derbyshire, Cornwall, and Essex, where the fighting was at its fiercest. They could talk of nothing but officers, and Mr. Bingley's large fortune, the mention of which gave animation to their mother, was worthless in their eyes when opposed to the regimentals of an ensign,
and the excited manner in which he spoke of beheading the stricken with a single touch of his sword. After listening one morning to their effusions on this subject, Mr. Bennet coolly observed, "From all that I can collect by your manner of talking, you must be two of the silliest girls in the country. I have suspected it some time, but I am now convinced."
"I am astonished, my dear," said Mrs. Bennet, "that you should be so ready to think your own children silly."
"If my children are silly, I must hope to be always sensible of it."
"Yes, but as it happens, they are all of them very clever. You forget how quickly they became proficient in those oriental tricks you insisted on bestowing them."
"Being practiced enough to kill a few of the sorry stricken does not make them sensible, particularly when their skills are most often applied for the amusement of handsome officers."
"Mamma," cried Lydia, "my aunt says that Colonel Foster and Captain Carter do not go so often to Miss Watson's as they did when they first came. She sees them now very often burning the crypts in Shepherd's Hill Cemetery."
Mrs. Bennet was prevented replying by the entrance of the footman with a note for Miss Bennet. It came from Netherfield, and the servant waited for an answer.
"Well, Jane, who is it from? What is it about?"
"It is from Miss Bingley," said Jane, and then read it aloud. "My dear friend, if you are not so compassionate as to dine today with Louisa and me, we shall be in danger of hating each other for the rest of our lives, for a whole day's tête-à-tête between two women can never end without a quarrel. Come as soon as you can on receipt of this, provided the road is free of the unmentionable menace. My brother and the gentleman are to dine with the officers. Yours ever, Caroline Bingley."
"Dining out?" said Mrs. Bennet. "That is very unlucky, given the troubles on the road to Netherfield."
"Can I have the carriage?" said Jane.
"No, my dear. You had better go on horseback, because it seems likely to rain, and they spring so easily from the wet earth. I should prefer you have speed at your disposal. Besides, if it rains, you must stay all night."
"That would be a good scheme," said Elizabeth, "if you were sure that they would not offer to send her home."
"I'd much rather go in the coach," said Jane, clearly troubled by the thought of riding alone. "But, my dear, your father cannot spare the horses, I am sure. They are wanted in the farm, Mr. Bennet, are they not?"
"They are wanted in the farm much oftener than I can get them, and too many slaughtered upon the road already." Jane was therefore obliged to go on horseback, and her mother attended her to the door with many cheerful prognostics of a bad day. Her hopes were answered. Jane had not been gone long before it rained hard, and the soft ground gave way to scores of the disagreeable creatures, still clad in their tattered finery, but possessing none of the good breeding that had served them so well in life. Her sisters were uneasy for her, but her mother was delighted. The rain continued the whole evening without intermission. Jane certainly could not come back.
"This was a lucky idea of mine indeed," said Mrs. Bennet more than once, as if the credit of making it rain were all her own.
Till the next morning, however, she was not aware of all the felicity of her contrivance. Breakfast was scarcely over when a servant from Netherfield brought the following note for Elizabeth.
"My dearest Lizzie, I find myself very unwell this morning, which, I suppose, is to be imputed to my being set upon by several freshly unearthed unmentionables during my ride to Netherfield. My kind friends will not hear of my returning till I am better. They insist also on my seeing Mr. Jones. Therefore, do not be alarmed if you should hear of his having been to me, and excepting a few bruises and a minor stab wound, there is not much the matter with me. Yours, etc."
"Well, my dear," said Mr. Bennet, when Elizabeth had read the note aloud, "if your daughter should die, or worse, succumb to the strange plague, it would be a comfort to know that it was all in pursuit of Mr. Bingley and under your orders."
"Oh, I am not afraid of her dying. People do not die of cuts and bruises. She will be taken good care of."
Elizabeth, feeling really anxious, was determined to go to her, though the carriage was not to be had, and as she was no horsewoman, walking was her only alternative. She declared her resolution.
"How can you be so silly?" cried her mother.
As to think of such a thing, with so many of them about, and in all this dirt, you will not be fit to be seen when you get there, assuming you make it alive.
You forget that I am a student of Pei Liu of Shaolin, Mother. Besides, for every unmentionable one meets upon the road, one meets three soldiers. I shall be back by dinner.
We will go as far as Meryton with you, said Catherine and Lydia.
Elizabeth accepted their company, and they set off together, armed only with their ankle daggers. Muskets and katana swords were a more effective means of protecting oneself, but they were considered unladylike, and having no saddle in which to conceal them, the three sisters yielded to modesty.
If we make haste, said Lydia, as they walked cautiously along, perhaps we may see something of Captain Carter before he goes.
In Meryton they parted. The two youngest repaired to the lodgings of one of the officers' wives, and Elizabeth continued her walk alone, crossing field after field at a quick pace, jumping over stiles and springing over puddles. During this impatient activity, a bootlace came undone. Not wanting to appear unkempt upon her arrival at Netherfield, she knelt down to tie it. There was suddenly a terrible shriek, not unlike that which hogs make while being butchered. Elizabeth knew at once what it was, and reached for her ankle dagger most expeditiously. She turned, blade at the ready, and was met with the regrettable visage of three unmentionables, their arms outstretched and mouths agape. The closest seemed freshly dead, his burial suit not yet discoloured and his eyes not yet dust. He lumbered toward Elizabeth at an impressive pace, and when he was but an arm's length from her, she plunged the dagger into his chest and pulled it skyward. The blade continued upward, cutting through his neck and face until it burst through the very top of his skull. He fell to the ground and was still. The second unmentionable was a lady, and much longer dead than her companion. She rushed at Elizabeth, her clawed fingers swaying clumsily about. Elizabeth lifted her skirt, disregarding modesty, and delivered a swift kick to the creature's head, which exploded in a cloud of brittle skin and bone. She too fell and was no more. The third was unusually tall, and though long dead, still possessed a great deal of strength and quickness. Elizabeth had not yet recovered from her kick when the creature seized her arm and forced the dagger from it. She pulled free before he could get his teeth on her, and took the crane position, which she thought appropriate for an opponent of such height. The creature advanced, and Elizabeth landed a devastating chop across its thighs. The limbs broke off, and the unmentionable fell to the ground, helpless. She retrieved her dagger and beheaded the last of her opponents, lifting its head by the hair and letting her battle cry be known for a mile in every direction. Elizabeth found herself at last within view of the house, with weary ankles, dirty stockings, and a face glowing with the warmth of exercise. She was shown into the breakfast parlour, where all but Jane were assembled, and where her appearance created a great deal of surprise. That she should have walked 3 miles with so many unmentionables about, in such dirty weather, and by herself, was almost incredible to Mrs. Hurst and Miss Bingley, and Elizabeth was convinced that they held her in contempt for it. She was received, however, very politely by them, and in their brother's manners there was something better than politeness. There was good humour and kindness. Mr. Darcy said very little, and Mr. Hurst nothing at all. The former was divided between admiration of the brilliancy which exercise had given to her complexion, and doubt as to the occasions justifying her to take the great risk of coming alone, with nothing but a dagger between her and death. The latter was thinking only of his breakfast. Her inquiries after her sister were not very favourably answered. Miss Bennet had slept ill, and though up, was very feverish and not well enough to leave her room. Elizabeth attended her, silently worrying that her beloved sister had caught the strange plague. When breakfast was over, they were joined by the sisters, and Elizabeth began to like them herself when she saw how much affection and solicitude they showed for Jane. The apothecary came, and having examined his patient, said, much to the relief of all, that she had caught not the strange plague, but a violent cold, no doubt from doing battle in the rain. When the clock struck 3, Elizabeth felt that she must go. Miss Bingley offered her the carriage. When Jane testified such concern in parting with her, Miss Bingley was obliged to convert the offer to an invitation to remain at Netherfield for the present. Elizabeth most thankfully consented, and a servant was dispatched to Longbourn to acquaint the family with her stay and bring back a supply of clothes, and at Elizabeth's request, her favourite musket. Chapter 8. At 5 o'clock, Elizabeth retired to meditate and dress, and at 6:30 she was summoned to dinner. Jane was by no means better. The sisters, on hearing this, repeated 3 or 4 times how much they were grieved, how shocking it was to have a bad cold, and how excessively they disliked being ill themselves, and then thought no more of the matter. Their indifference towards Jane, when not immediately before them, restored Elizabeth to her former dislike. Their brother, Mr. Bingley, was the only one of the party whom she could regard with any complacency. His anxiety for Jane was evident, and his attentions to herself most pleasing, and they prevented her feeling herself so much an intruder as she believed she was considered by the others. When dinner was over, Elizabeth returned directly to Jane, and Miss Bingley began abusing her as soon as she was out of the room. Her manners were pronounced to be very bad indeed, a mixture of pride and impertinence. She had no conversation, no style, no beauty. Mrs. Hurst thought the same, and added, "She has nothing, in short, to recommend her but being well schooled in the ways of combat. I shall never forget her appearance this morning. She really looked almost wild."
"She did indeed, Louisa. Why must she be scampering about the country in such dangerous times because her sister had a cold, her hair so untidy, so blousy?"
"Yes, and her petticoat. I hope you saw her petticoat. 6 inches deep in mud, I'm absolutely certain, and pieces of undead flesh upon her sleeve, no doubt from her attackers." "Your picture may be very exact, Louisa," said Bingley, "but this was all lost upon me. I thought Miss Elizabeth Bennet looked remarkably well when she came into the room this morning. Her dirty petticoat quite escaped my notice."
"You observed it, Mr. Darcy, I am sure," said Miss Bingley, "and I am inclined to think that you would not wish to see your sister make such an exhibition."
"Certainly not."
"To walk 3 miles, or whatever it is, above her ankles in dirt, and alone, quite alone, with the unmentionable menace dragging poor souls off the road to their doom day and night? What could she mean by it? It seems to me to show an abominable sort of conceited independence, a most country town indifference to decorum."
"It shows an affection for her sister that is very pleasing," said Bingley.
"I am afraid, Mr. Darcy," observed Miss Bingley in a half-whisper, "that this adventure has rather affected your admiration of her fine eyes."
"Not at all," he replied. "They were brightened by the exercise." A short pause followed this speech, and Mrs. Hurst began again.
"I have an excessive regard for Miss Jane Bennet. She is really a very sweet girl, and I wish with all my heart she were well settled. But with such a father and mother, and such low connections, I am afraid there is no chance of it."
"I think I have heard you say that their uncle is an attorney on Meryton?"
"Yes, and they have another who lives somewhere near Cheapside."
"That is capital," added her sister,
and they both laughed heartily.
"If they had uncles enough to fill all Cheapside," cried Bingley, "it would not make them one jot less agreeable. Have you no regard for them as warriors? Indeed, I have never seen ladies so steady-handed in combat."
"But it must very materially lessen their chance of marrying men of any consideration in the world," replied Darcy. To this speech Bingley made no answer, but his sisters gave it their hearty assent. With a renewal of tenderness, however, they returned to Jane's room on leaving the dining-parlour, and sat with her till summoned to coffee. She was still very poorly, and Elizabeth would not quit her at all till late in the evening, when she had the comfort of seeing her sleep, and when it seemed to her rather right than pleasant that she should go downstairs herself. On entering the drawing-room, she found the whole party at cards, and was immediately invited to join them, but suspecting them to be playing high, she declined it, and making her sister the excuse, said she would amuse herself for the short time she could stay below with a book. Mr. Hurst looked at her with astonishment.
"Do you prefer reading to cards?" said he. "That is rather singular."
"I prefer a great many things to cards, Mr. Hurst," said Elizabeth.
not the least of which is the sensation of a newly sharpened blade as it punctures the round belly of a man. Mr. Hurst was silent for the remainder of the evening.
"In nursing your sister, I am sure you have pleasure," said Bingley, "and I hope it will soon be increased by seeing her quite well."
Elizabeth thanked him, and then walked towards the table where a few books were lying. He immediately offered to fetch her others, all that his library afforded.
"And I wish my collection were larger for your benefit and my own credit, but I am an idle fellow, and though I have not many, I have more than I have ever looked into."
Elizabeth assured him that she could suit herself perfectly with those in the